Welcome to the Sustainable Ag Writer Podcast, a podcast bringing you news and views about sustainable agriculture from across the southeastern United States. Every show will feature insightful interviews and deep dives into sustainable agriculture topics with farmers, ranchers, land-grant universities, and local food system advocates. Now, here's your host, Brennan Washington.
Welcome to the Sustainable Ag Writer Podcast. I'm Brennan Washington, and I'm your host. Thank you for joining me on this very dreary day. It's raining, it's cloudy, it's overcast, just like the last opening I did in the cooperative segment. But all is well. This water will do us good when it comes time to planting time. So I'm not complaining. Hope you all well. Hope you all taking care of each other, doing what you need to do to stay safe from COVID. I hope that most of the people in Texas at least gotten back to some semblance of normal. That was a really tough week that they were in, but I think most people pull through it. They're just having to rebuild in the aftermath. I'm really looking forward to today's show. It's about the Southern Sayre Ag Leadership Cohort. And you're going to have the opportunity to listen to four highly engaged, energetic individuals who are working on some projects around sustainable agriculture in their communities. I think helping to groom leadership is extremely important. I think sometimes that we don't do enough of that, both within our nonprofits, within our political spheres. The old guard's not always going to be there forever. And so I think it's incumbent upon all of us who do this type of work and who've been doing it for a while, you know, to identify folks who can carry the torch on and to help groom and encourage folks to do the work that we're doing and the work that we need done, especially as it applies to sustainable agriculture and growing our own food and just helping to build more resilient communities. I think that's very important. So I'm really looking forward to this set of interviews today. I had the opportunity to go through two leadership programs. The first one, which was, oh my God, almost 10 years ago now, maybe if not a little longer, was the Southern University Small Farm Agricultural Leadership Program. That's a long title, so many of us who went through the program just called it Ag Leadership. It was started by Dr. Dawn Million Patan of Southern University, who recently retired. I don't know who told her she could retire, but she has left behind quite a legacy. I think she had eight legacies of that leadership class. I was in class three. Quite a few people who have been on my show, will be on my show, have also gone through that class. And she's actually seeded a Southern agriculture with some extremely competent and energetic people. And that leadership program was essentially Dr. Dawn saw a need for a leadership program for people of color involved in agriculture. So most of the large land-grant universities like University of Georgia or Oklahoma State, a lot of these institutions have leadership programs, but they were out of the reach for people like me. You had to pay a fee that was kind of expensive. When there was travel involved, that was pretty much on your own dime. It was out of reach for a lot of people. So Dr. Dawn saw that there was a need. She applied for some grant funding. And I got to tell you, with her program, she'd bring in anywhere from 15 people in a cohort for each class. All your expenses were covered. All Dr. Dawn asks is that you really engage with the program, that you come there, you came, that know what you were there to do. And that was to learn what you needed to learn to go back and be good leaders in your community. She put together this program with the cooperation of most of the 1890s in the South. So when we went to, we would always start out at Southern and then we would visit different states. So we would go to North Carolina and spend some time with North Carolina A&T. Or we would go to Texas and spend some time with Prairie View A&M. Or we would go to Alabama and spend some time with Tuskegee. And it was farm tours and it was classwork. And it was really, really an enriching experience for me. And I'm sure some of my other classmates would say the same thing. And it really helped solidify the work that I'm doing and ground me in the work that I'm doing and have been doing since I took part in that cohort. I also had a chance to become part of the University of Georgia's Advancing Georgia Leaders in Agriculture program, the AGL program. It was a little bit different leadership program from the Southern program. It dealt with more conventional type agricultural operations. So we learned about, you know, we got to visit sawmills. We learned about the timber industry here in Georgia. We learned about the poultry industry. And it was interesting, you know, overall it wasn't my sandbox, but it's really nice to see the wide base of agricultural operations throughout the state. This particular program had an international trip as part of the curriculum. And so we got to go to Costa Rica, which was absolutely amazing. And then the last leadership program I took part in, I was selected to become a member of the Business Alliance of Local Living Economies, BALLE, as it was known. This leadership program brought together individuals from across North America, Canada, and the United States to talk about how to build more resilient local economies. You know, in our cohort, we talked a lot about, you know, how do we improve the financial system so that it's fairer and more socially just. The cohort I was in, there was a specific focus on rural communities. So once again, we went different locations around the country. We went to St. Helena Islands. We went to a large conference out in Monterey in California. And it was a different experience for me because it wasn't simply agriculture, but it covered all of the different facets and different components of what can make a truly resilient local economy. So it was extremely, and in all three of these leadership cohorts, you know, I met friends that I continue to talk to. My roommate in BALLE was a Mexican American from Colorado, and we would just stay up and have some old fashions and just talk about our lives and our experiences. I always try and give back now, whether it means trying to help folks get to conferences or whatever way I can help to help them to help other people, I'm all in for it. So today's, you're going to meet this cohort today. During the interview, you hear a little bit about how this program originated and what our plans are for the future. But most importantly, you get to see the work that people are doing on the ground. One of the things I'm very fortunate about is that I actually get to go out and meet people where they are on the ground. You know, that's why I drive everywhere, because when you meet somebody where they are, and when you walk a piece of land with a farmer, or you talk about their crops, or you talk about how the farm, the family history of the farm, first of all, there's a sense of pride when you talk to folks like that. Second of all, there's appreciation. You're coming there not to promise them anything, but to understand where they're coming from and what challenges they have and what they want to do for their communities. I remember, Miss Felicia Bell, who you'll hear in this, who's one of these cohort members, took me on a tour of Mississippi. We got to meet people just right there in Mississippi. You know, one of the interesting things about my job is until I got this, I had really thought I knew most of the organizations working around small scale agriculture, and especially those organizations dealing with farmers of color. And boy, I could not have been more wrong. Miss Felicia took myself and Alcee Parks, who works with SAFON, the Southeastern African American Farmers Organic Network. And we just spent pretty much a whole day driving around parts of Mississippi. And I really got to meet some interesting folks that I still work with to this day. I got to meet Calvin Head, who heads up the Milestone Cooperative in a very, very, very poor county in Mississippi. And I've been able to work with Cal and bring some resources to bear for the work that he's doing in there. And we got to see the Pineywood School, Mississippi, which was, if I'm not mistaken, an old black boarding school. And that's where I started to get an introduction into black boarding schools, because I didn't even know they existed. You know, I ain't going to front. I didn't know there was such a thing as black boarding schools, but they were, and they have a rich history. And so I got to see all that stuff, identify folks who are doing this good work and just need some encouragement and resources to help them continue to build up their communities. Folks aren't looking for a handout, people. They are looking for people who want to come in, understand that their work that they're doing truly offer help and support and help and support and, you know, a willingness to see the vision that they see for their community. So I'm not going to talk too long on this opening segment this week. One thing I would like to point out is this is a labor of love for me. I don't get any money for doing this. In fact, it costs me some money out of my pocket. I just think it's important to bring these voices to farmers of color and just farmers in general. Just have another method of communication other than Facebook, other than blogs, for people to hear about what other folks are doing around agriculture, particularly here in the South. So if you like what you hear, can you do me a favor and just give me a rate me on iTunes or on Stitcher? Can you subscribe to the podcast? Because in the long run, that's going to help me out with trying to keep this going. Starting next week, we're actually going to get into actual agricultural topics. You know, for most of 2020, we dealt a lot with organizations that are doing work in this space. And we also dealt with 1,000-foot views of sustainable ag. So we talked about, the state of small-scale agriculture. We talked about urban agriculture, but I really haven't touched yet on actual agricultural topics. Next week, we'll be having an interview with Justin Duncan of NCAT, and we're going to be talking about soils and what's healthy soils and what you can do to ensure that you have healthy soils on your farm. And then the week following that, we're going to have Miss Felicia Bell on to talk about prepping your market garden for this coming season. So we're going to start to bring more of that agricultural stuff in there. And before I let you go, I'm going to let you in on a little secret. My plan for this podcast was to do this podcast, to do a lot of remote interviews. As I say, meeting people where they are. And I was not only going to do the podcast from the road and bring you all these interesting people, but I was also going to write a book. And I still have that plan. My plan is to write a book to tell the stories of all these people that not many people know about, but who are in there working. I mean, I'm talking about people like John and Carolyn Jones up in the upper corner of Mississippi, who has started just an outstanding farmers program that has an outstanding youth component in it. But that's my goal. And hopefully we can get this COVID behind us and I can get back out on the road and bring you those, man in the field interviews, so to speak, so you can meet these folks. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce you to the cohort of the Southern Sierra Agricultural Leadership Program. Please rate us up on iTunes and any other streaming services that you have. And if you have any questions or you want to contact me, just shoot me an info. You can either go to the website and go to the Contact Us page to get me a message, you know, anything for show ideas or any comments you have on the show. But you can go to the contact page or you can send me an email at info@sustainableagwriter.com. And without further ado, here is our interview. Okay, welcome back to another edition of the Sustainable Ag Writer. I am so happy to have this panel of guests here with me. Southern Sierras, as some of you know, one of the things we do is that we give out sponsorship money for people to hold conferences, put on field days and workshops, mainly to hold educational events. Well, ever since COVID, nobody's doing that stuff, at least not in person. And so we were stuck with this dilemma of having this money that we weren't spending. And if we didn't spend it by a certain time, we'd have to send it back to DC, which is a no-no for us. We like to make sure that money stays on the ground with the people that we're trying to serve. So we came up with this idea of a sustainable ag leadership program. And it's been a little bit of a bumpy ride, mainly because I don't think we thought through what we wanted to. But we put it out there and we got about 20 or 25 applications. And I'm so happy today to have the four recipients of these first Ag Leadership Fellowships. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce you to our participants. We have Ms. Felicia Bell, RD&S Farms out of Mississippi,
Najwa Thomas out of Earth People Farms out of South Carolina, Cedric Rowe with Rowe Organic Farms out of Georgia, and Otis Wright with Ag Eco out of Mississippi. And I guess, folks, the first thing we're going to do is go around and I want you to introduce yourself, tell people a little bit about the work that you've done, and then I want you to talk a little bit about the project you're going to be doing. So, Najma, we'll start with you.
Brandon, thank you so much, and good evening to my fellow cohort members. So I am a member of a small sustainable farm, Earth People Farms, in the Lowcountry of South Carolina, Beaufort, South Carolina. We're on St. Helena Island, to be exact. And we farm in the Gullah Geechee agricultural tradition, which is really, rooted in traditional Africanisms, sustainable use of waterways, living in balance with the earth. So we're a micro farm. Vegetable, herbs, and fruit are our products. And in addition to my work on the farm, I am also a faculty member at the University of South Carolina, Beaufort. So my background is public policy and administration. And what I try to do with my my work in the community is really marry Gullah Geechee agriculture with policy analysis. And for the last, for the last 5 years, I've been really working with a couple of different groups here, trying to raise and amplify this idea around racial equity in agriculture. And not just me. I mean, there are a lot of people in our area that are working on this and have been working on it diligently. And I think we're coalescing around this idea now and finally getting some resources, some traction, and some, some good press on the work that a lot of groups and organizations have been doing for a long time. So that's kind of where I'm living, at the intersection of small farming and policy, and really trying to engage that next generation of farmers. A lot of our farmers in the Lowcountry, they're elders, 70, 80 years old. We have we're different than a lot of farmers that we come into contact with, in that we've got a lot of land. We've got a lot of land, and our farmers are getting to the age where they want to transfer in a meaningful, responsible way. So that's some work that I am also engaged in, really trying to connect this next generation of farmers with our elder farmers, transfer those skills, get that land, transferred as well, but make sure it's maintained and, in Gullah Geechee ownership and sustainable agriculture. So I don't know if that was too much or not enough. You let me know.
That was perfect. But now let's tell everybody a little bit about the specific project you're going to be doing. So I'm going to tell everybody who's listening, the goal of this program was to assign some funding to each of the members of our cohort for them to do a particular project in their community or where they're at. So tell us a little bit about the project you're going to be doing.
Absolutely. So what I proposed to do was to present a series of workshops to smaller farmers in the Gullah Geechee community and other historically underserved populations. And I wanted to look at three different topics. The first is equity in the context of agriculture. And then, looking at farm planning and techniques for small scale operations to transfer knowledge and resources to the next generation. And then also how to navigate federal, state, and local resources so that our smaller scale farms can have the opportunity to access some of these resources that are available, but that they feel like they cannot tap into either because they don't have the connections or the skills. So, you mentioned this already, Brennan, with COVID, we had to take a different tactic and really, especially with our elder farmers who don't like to do a lot of stuff online, really do in-person support for them and then try to connect them to the resources online so that they can see, it's not that difficult if you have the support. So that's what I'm doing, a little bit of presentation, a little bit of technical assistance in person with our elder farmer.
All right. Well, thank you, Najma.
You're welcome.
Mr. Wright, how are you? I'm going to let everybody know, since he's a proud daddy, Otis and his wife were blessed with a bouncing baby boy. What, about 2 months ago now, Otis?
3 months, November 7th.
3 months ago, and he's a proud daddy. He posts pictures of him on Facebook. Although I think them women were going to, he got him out in the snow the other day, and I think them women were going to drive to Mississippi and tar and feather you, man. They was like, get that baby out the cold. So Otis, tell everybody a little bit about yourself and about the project you're going to be doing.
Okay. Well, I'm a proud father. Let me say that first. I'm a proud husband too. And so for the last 10 years, I've been in the nonprofit area as far as providing technical assistance to Black farmers. I started off with the Mississippi Association of Cooperatives on the USDA 2501 program. That's the Mississippi branch of the Federation of Southern Cooperatives that's housed in Georgia. And then after that, I went on to actually be over a USDA 2501 program that was at Tougaloo College through the Owens Health and Wellness Center. And I provided I managed the program. And we provided technical assistance in 13 counties in the Mississippi Delta. So pretty much the whole Mississippi Delta we were covering. And so I did that till they decided to go another route with the programs that was being coming out of that area. And so we ended up getting laid off. But I went in to do urban farming with the Jackson Medical Mall. And so for the last 3 years, I've been doing urban farming there. And so now I'm 3 weeks old on this new job. I am the tech specialist for Hinds County Soil and Water Conservation District, which is right under the NRCS. We're housed in the same building. So I assist the soil techs and the other tech guys that's there. And so my project that I propose to do, I'm in the process of finishing those up, getting those so we can put them out. We wanted to do two workshops, one that was focused on cooperative development. I felt like with COVID and everything else that's going on, like there is a big need for people to come together in order to not only just accumulate wealth, but just really to take care of each other. And so I wanted to do a workshop that's focusing on the importance of cooperative development. And then my other workshop I am going to do is based on just urban farming and farming in small spaces. Here in Jackson, we have we're up to maybe 15 registered farms that are in the city of Jackson. It's in the city limits. And so it's really a big deal now. And other people who never even thought about even shopping at farmers markets and things are now like really into farmers markets and like urban farming, and people want to know about it, and people are trying to just get more information on it. So we wanted to do a workshop that be focused on people taking care of people feeding people. And so I also manage a urban farm site at Tougaloo College. We have a high tunnel and we have a traditional row garden too. And so I'm bringing all of that together, and we're going to do a big thing on urban farming and how we can feed ourselves.
Okay, so when you say 15 registered farms, those are actual farms with farming track numbers?
Yeah.
Oh, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, and so these are neighborhood farms. Some are big, like, of course, footprint farms for Dr. Ayers. She's farming, she has like 6 or 7 high tunnels, but all the rest of them are like acres, half acre lots, lot size, 2 lots. People, we had a person, he bought like 2 or 3 lots in the neighborhood. He decided they didn't want to farm on them. He has a high tunnel on them now. But yeah, that's like it's like 12 or 15 registered farms now right here in the city. So that's something.
Watch out, boy, and Mississippi's a sleeper.
Right. Yep.
Yeah.
So we're trying to turn Jackson into the Garden City.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Miss Felicia.
Hello, Mr. Brandon. Appreciate you so much.
Miss Felicia, everybody says I know a lot of people. But boy, you can't go up or down at any of these conferences and nobody know who you are. Everybody know who Miss Felicia is. So Felicia, tell everybody about yourself, all the wonderful work you have done and continue to do agriculture and farming.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much. And it's been just a wonderful opportunity to be a part of this project. Born and raised a Mississippian. I'm fourth generation. My sons are fifth generation, ages 28, 15, and 8. And this is all I know is traditional agriculture. And I call it that because it's stemming from my African culture. Most of the things that have been done on this land and from generations down were African instilled into our families, but it took my generation to come along and learn and read and internet searches to realize that's what it was. But I'm very grateful to have that knowledge and have been brought up in that. So in 2003, we started our own farm, my oldest son and I. And at that time, people needed help. The older farmers, and I had, again, been in this my whole life, so I knew a lot of these farmers, and I wanted to assist them with those type of practices, traditional practices, sustainable practices, where one, they didn't have to get inundated with chemicals on their land and or they're having health issues because of the things they were using. And then the second thing is I wanted them to make money. I have been around them that my whole life, and I've never seen them make any money from their land. So that was the beginning of our technical assistance from our farm. We did do all the Southeast states except Florida. I didn't ever drive that far. I was doing it on my dime, my money, and just my son and I. We did it for many, many years. Fast forward to 2013, I got hired with the National Center for Appropriate Technology as an ag specialist to basically continue what I had always been doing. So it was a blessing to be able to do that. And I always tell them, I was very transparent. I was grateful to be with them because now I have a bigger budget. I don't have to pull from my money anymore in my own pocket. So I'm very transparent about that because I could continue to help farmers in the Southeast United States. So the proposed project that that I want to do in our area and really still in this region, that Southeast region, is to help farmers look at market gardening. Most of our farmers, especially our elders, still grow with too much spacing in the rows because that's what we were taught. But now we're coming fast forward and it's more intensive growing as well as intensive grazing. So everything is tight-knit now, and you can make so much more money on just square foot. And that's what I want to teach the farmers. So the way we did this, a former coworker, friend now, is Sam Humphreys. He's like the guru of market gardening in our area in central Mississippi. And so I had a team to come out to interview him on camera and share what he have done and how he sets up his market gardening. That will be placed on a flash drive along with market gardening books. And then I'm shipping them out to the various cooperatives around the Southeast. So that was what I really wanted to do because I want our farmers to learn how to grow more intensively. So again, that money maker, be able to grow tight, but then you have more to offer at the end of the season.
Okay. And Felicia, I'm not going to let you leave yet without talking about all the enterprises you and your family do. So your youngest son has written, what, one or two books?
It's the middle son. The middle son.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
So when I always bring my children up for a fifth generation, they truly are agriculturalists. They're not laborers. They truly helped me when they were younger, like I was. I always tell people born in agriculture. You know, loving family, you help your family out. It's not a grueling thing. You're not pulling back and pushing back and having issues. It's just part of our lifestyle. And so my sons went through the same thing. And so to this day, the oldest, his business is called Farmhand Carrier. He does farm infrastructure. He helps farmers, especially older farmers in the Southeast, with farm infrastructure, repair, farm sitting, those types of things, because he have done it his whole life. The middle son is the one that has two businesses because he had two interests. First, he wrote a book on beneficial insects. So he's our farm entomologist. entitled Bee Bug, Beneficial Insects for Farmers and Gardeners. Again, we do chemical free for many, many generations on this land. And so he wanted to teach our farmers how to utilize beneficial insect versus pesticides. So that was his end to the farmers. And then the second thing he does that ramped up tremendously because it's a food item. He's a baker, so he does vegan donuts. And he have added some other things. And so that's going to be coming out this year, the other treats, but they're still vegan. And then the last little boy that most people don't even know exists, he's an 8-year-old, but he is into cut flowers. And so we have a blessing here. We have a cut flower cooperative here locally. And so he gets a lot of help from Miss Donna Yao with the Flower Growers of Mississippi. So thank you, Mr. Brennan, for letting me share my boys, because yes, I'm proud of them.
Yeah. You know, keeping it in the family is the way to go. Now we move over to Big Sed. Sed, how you doing tonight?
I'm good. How about you?
All right. So Cedric Rose, organic farmer from down in Georgia, a little bit south of me. And before I let Sed tell you about himself, I'm going to tell you about my wife got a hold of his number, and Sed grows these amazing watermelons. And she said, well, I got to go. I swear, it seemed like we were almost doing a drug deal. We were down in Atlanta and we were driving. Cedric told us to look for a gold parking lot. And we looking for this thing. We driving all around. Right there in the parking lot. And people started seeing us pull these watermelons and load them from his truck to our truck. We had a postman stop by. I wanted to get some. And they were too delicious. But Sed, tell everybody about yourself and then tell them a little bit about the project you're going to be doing.
Okay. My name is Cedric Rowe. I'm from Albany, Georgia. I'm a first generation farmer, young farmer, 29 years old. I started my career off when I graduated from Fort Valley State University with a bachelor's degree in plant science. After I left there, I went and worked for a nonprofit organization named Southwest Georgia Projects, where I was an ag specialist there. Being an ag specialist there, I worked there 2 years, where we dealt with farmers in rural areas and also farmers with, you know, limited resources. And I did 2 years there working for a nonprofit, so got an understanding on working with policies and working with organizations. I left that nonprofit after 2 years and proceeded to work on my master's degree, which I later received in 2019 in public health with a concentration in environmental health. During that tenure, I also was working at Fort Valley State as the greenhouse manager. So I got experience working in greenhouse. Did that for a year, 2020. That's when I stopped working at Fort Valley. I was on a contracted job there. I was on a contract, so my contract ended. The entire last year, I started a chapter of South Georgia Young Farmers Coalition, which is a subchapter up under the National Young Farmers Coalition. I serve as the president, also as a board member of the National Young Farmers Coalition. So I got a lot of experience when it comes to policy. Also, I started one of the three farmers in Georgia that started the Organic Peanut Association and also the market of organic peanuts in Georgia. It started as a research project I was doing with Georgia Organics. Where I was growing three different varieties of organic peanuts. And now I grow peanuts, and not only grow, but my final product is my own peanut butter, which Georgia Grinders process and sells for the farmers that grow organic peanuts. It's not a lot of organic farmers in the state of Georgia. We're under that 250 farmer, organic farmer mark. A lot of people are small scale. A lot of my work deal with policy when it comes to my organization that I'm president of. And now, all last year, Georgia was just now able to start growing hemp. So I was one of the 132 growers last year that grew hemp first, Black minority grower in South Georgia, youngest. Then also, I treat my hemp as my do my peanuts. So I also have a final where I grow hemp, and also have a final product where I deal with a pharmaceutical company that actually can make it into my own certified FDA hemp oil. So I have organic peanut butter and also organic hemp oil that's about to be available on the market. That's a little about what I know, my life and what I do. And currently what I was going to do with the funding from the organization is basically teach people how to, in my community, farmer people are always looking for new ways to make money in farming. A lot of people stick to the traditional ways of growing collards or typical things that every other farmer grow that they know would be hard to sell. So I was successful at growing peanuts and hemp, and out of 132 growers in Georgia, under 20 was successful at growing hemp in the state of Georgia the first year. So with me being one of the 20, I felt like I could share my knowledge to people on the proper way of growing hemp, not only that, but organic and safe way to grow it. If you're people that, once you understand how to grow, you'll understand the policy, because you it's license and requirements that have, that comes with that, that all falls up under the farm bill and everything else. My main concern is people understanding the farm bill. The basis, the main document that states, you know, how things operate, certain crops. You know, if you can understand certain crops, you understand the farm bill, it can help you in the area that you're trying to farm in or things you're trying to do. So I wanted to focus on something different that other organizations don't typically focus on when you have a conference or an event. A lot of people train people how to farm and this, that, and, you know, a lot of people need that, but the people that's doing it and been doing it and always just been stuck. I mean, we can relate, Black people access to land, but don't know what to do with it. We also have access to land, but we feel comfortable in someone else's hand rather than our family hand. So if we can help resolve those issues when understanding things, it can bring people more attached back to the farm and, you know, like knowing what's right and what's wrong. That's the biggest thing.
Your project is going to be educate. Are you the only Black farm in Georgia growing hemp?
I'm the, it's one more lady. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Let's see. You know,
Miss Dora Jefferson out of South, she's also in Auburn also.
Okay. Okay. All right. And your project's going to be just teaching, which I think is a great project because, you know, I've heard horror stories about what happened to some of our people when they try and get to this hemp game, you know, getting ripped off with seed or not preparing their soils properly. Before we start on some general questions that I have for all of you, both Najma and Felicia are working around Gullah Geechee communities. So I'd like each of you to take a couple of minutes just to explain what Gullah Geechee is. You know, it's funny, and I'm not saying, I'm probably showing my lack of history as I was growing up, but the only time I heard the word Geechee was in the movie Cotton Comes to Harlem. It was Geechee Dan with, I forgot who played him. And sometimes you would hear it used as a pejorative, you know, oh, it's, you know, that's Geechee and, you know, all that stuff. But if you ladies wouldn't mind taking a minute just to explain to people exactly what Gullah Geechee is and why you think it's so important to help support, uplift that community. Najma, you can go first.
Okay. You know, let me talk a little bit about the negative connotation. Let's just go ahead and get that out of the way. Because, Brennan, you're not inaccurate in saying that probably some of the few times you heard Geechee or Gullah was in a negative connotation. And you know, that goes back to the way that people of African descent have been portrayed writ large. You know, just the history books, our teachers, Black and white, y'all, in many instances have been trained to look at anything that's different from quote unquote mainstream as backwards or ignorant or uninformed. And then if you look at the miseducation that has been brought forward in the area of history, you know, there's a lot of documentation, quote unquote, of Gullah Geechee people where they were presented as talking in broken English, baby talk, you know, and all of that kind of inaccurate portrayal of people in my community has really led to this negative connotation around Gullah Geechee. And it's only been, I would say, in the last 20 or so years that there has been a reclamation, if you would. But the evidence that supports what we know to be Gullah Geechee culture in the Lowcountry, that has been very well documented by folks like Dr. Lorenzo Dow Turner, who is a linguist. And unlike a lot of the historians or anthropologists or even linguists of the time who came to the Lowcountry, and the Lowcountry, yo, when I say that, I'm talking about Jackson, North Carolina, all the way down to Jacksonville, Florida, towards the coast. And, you know, they would come into these areas, especially before bridges were in place, in these remote locations where people who really retain Africanisms, the way we talk, the way, you know, our life ways, our food ways, our spiritual practices, all had really significant connections to traditional Africanisms and African way of life. And of course, that was possible because people who were enslaved in these regions were not as integrated with, European society as those who were maybe working outside of the Lowcountry. So because we were in the islands and away from, you know, the quote unquote city, we were able to retain our Africanisms, naming practices, you know, spiritual practices, the way we work the land. And so people would, you know, come to do their studies. And when I say people, y'all, I'm talking culturally incompetent people, people who were trained to look down on people of African descent wherever they are in the world. So looking at these poor Black folks down here in the country, you know, disconnected from everyone and seeing how, oh, they don't know how to talk and they don't know what's going on. When in fact, these folks were bilingual. I was bilingual when I left the Lowcountry, didn't know it, you know, and went to college and really wanted to anglicize my diction so as not to, you know, stand out and be made fun of and have my professors think that I'm ignorant. When again, in all actuality, I was bilingual. And Dr. Jow Turner documented, he's got, oh my goodness, interviews upon interviews, not only audio, but he documented in writing what he heard from these native Gullah speakers. And he interviewed elders, he interviewed middle-aged folks, so he interviewed men and women. And then when he would go to the continent and in various West African societies and interview them, and he was able to bridge this connection between all of these different African languages and the languages, what he heard and what he documented in the Sea Islands. So he made the connection. This was astounding work because for the first time ever, he showed a clear connection between Africa and the Lowcountry. Whereas other historians and other linguists said, you know, when Africans were enslaved and they came over from Africa, they brought nothing with them. And we all, you thinking people know that that's just inaccurate. But as foolish as it sounds to us right now, that was actually accepted in academic circles that there was no cultural retention. There was nothing that people who were enslaved here were able to retain. And Gullah Geechee culture just stands as a direct contradiction to that myth because we retained all of these practices that can be directly connected to ancient African practices, current African practices, the diaspora, wherever you find it, you can connect a lot of different things like the food ways, like I mentioned, like the spiritual practices to the ways in which we currently live in the Gullah Geechee culture. So, yeah, I'll pause there. And
that was a good oversight, you know. Yeah. It's almost like those lack of bridges and rivers served as a cultural barrier, you know?
A container, a cultural container. That's what, you know, that's what the islands were. They were a cultural container and really allowed us to thrive and continue well beyond, you know, periods of time where other folks were really integrated. And not to say that integration is a bad thing, y'all, but to say that, you know, you had to give up something. You had to give up a lot of things in order to properly integrate. And thankfully, Gullah Geechee people retain those things for us to learn from today.
Felicia, now, the part of Mississippi that you're in, I wouldn't think that's part of the Gullah Geechee community because you're further inland. So how'd you get involved in this?
So mine is researching and understanding and learning that the Gullah Geechee people were the only ones that were never touched by integration, by European context and so forth. So they weren't tainted. And so my research, I was looking for the food ways and the spirituality. So that's what led my search into learning about the Gullah Geechee people many, many, many years ago. And then had the awesome opportunity to visit, but I visited the Fields farm. Miss Helen Fields was a classmate of mine, ag leadership with Dr. Don Melion Patan in Southern University. So had the awesome opportunity to visit their farm and many farms in that area. And I just was blown away because nothing had changed.
You in class what? One or two?
No, I was in class two. I was after Mr. Frank.
You were in the class before me, yeah. You were in the class.
So that was my learning and understanding. And I was just so blown away because I got my answers because it had been untouched. And that's just been such a blessing to learn and to know that the strength of our enslaved ancestors in that area that just really empowered me to do and speak like I am today, that it's okay to share what my grandfather and elders knew in our lineage, that yes, it's African, it's nothing else. And so that's those men and women of that area just empowered me because they didn't ever fold. They never folded. They weren't trying to integrate because they had it all there. And that's what I was brought up in. We were homesteaders. Everything was here. Basically, all we got was sugar, flour, coffee. Everything else was from the land. And so I saw that similarity when I studied them, but it was strictly research, just really wanting to learn my Africanness. That's what I was researching. Yes, sir.
Gotcha. Okay, guys, y'all are relatively young compared. I think I could take Otis and Cedric and add you together, and I'm still older than both you guys. So, but I think it's really important. And one thing I really stress in the work that I do is that, you know, it's nice to respect your elders and to want to count on the wisdom of the elders. But I also think the elders need to make a path for the young folks. You know, I always, that's something I always try to do in my work is, you know, uplift the young folks. So the next question I have for you is, why do you do the work that you do? I mean, let's face it, farming's tough work. You're probably not going to get rich except in experiences. So, you know, all of you on this phone could probably another career, given the brain power on this call, and do something else. So why do you do the work that you do? And Otis, I'm going to start off with you.
Well, it was kind of passed down to me, the passion, not only farming, but to try to help people. I come from a family of people who were farmers, but let me back up and say this. My great grandfather is really he was the pusher. Now he died back in the early 1940s, but the type of legacy, the type of work that he actually left is what's pushing me today. So he was a farmer. He started off farming over here in the state of Mississippi. Then he just went over the river to Louisiana. He started off there as a sharecropper. Then he purchased about 300 and something acres. He had in the 1920s, he had white people that were working for him. He employed people. The African American children didn't have a elementary school, so he donated the property. 10 of his acres he gave to the local school board, and they built a school for Black kids, and that school is named after my family now. So that type of legacy is what's pushing me. It's like, you know, yeah, try to make money, try to do this and that, but don't forget about trying to help others, trying to help people. And so my drive for agriculture as a whole and for the work I do, yeah, I want to make money, but I also want to make sure that I'm helping somebody else. I want to make sure that, you know, when I do leave this earth, that people won't say, oh, he just made a lot of money. They'll say, oh, just help people. And I want to pass that down to my son, I believe. And if you see my posts, I always hashtag people helping people, because that's really where my heart is. That's where my passion is. So I say the things that's keeping me going in this agriculture field is the simple fact that I get to help people.
Okay. What about you, Sid?
What's keeping me going? Basically, I don't see a lot of young Black farmers in my area. So with me growing up around older people, I want to be that example, that, you know, that model to other young people, you know, once they see, you know, because basically we live in a generation where we're dealing with trendsetters. People follow what they see. People, you know, they, you know, it's all about what you see, what's hot at the moment. So, you know, I just took, you know, took that platform of social media and what I do and start just, you know, letting people know, you know, I farm. And when people think about it, you know, it's a, I'm under 30, and the average farmer is like 40 or 55 years old. So when I do it, ever since I started farming and I opened up the organization, I have over a dozen young farmers now that is coming out of the woodwork, taking over their family farm, wanting to learn this. That's why I grow stuff that catch interest of people to make them want to look at farming in a whole other way. So that's why I jumped out. I'm organic. I'm the only Black organic peanut grower in Georgia. Then I grow organic hemp. So when my generation hear about hemp, you already know how hot they get. Oh, man, I need to learn how to grow that. So now you're getting people more attached in to get more like, oh, yeah, you hear people say all the time, my family got land, or, you know, we have land, but they don't know what to do with it. So, you know, I feel like long as I'm young and I'm out here showing them that, look, farming is more than just what you think about it, you know, like what movies show you about it. This actually is something that you can pass down. I want to teach our people wealth rather than trying to get rich. You know, farming is preparing for the next generation. So just like my people prepared me, I'm a first generation farmer. My granddad taught me a lot. You know, he wasn't able to buy a farm. He was just able enough to take care of his family. So when I'm on the land, I'm doing that. I tell people, I stopped working at Fort Valley State and farm a whole year off of retirement money, teacher retirement money, and, you know, little stuff that I had. And I did that all last year. And I basically sacrificed and lost to be able to show people and also better myself. And, you know, ever since 2018, I can say I haven't, you know, I tell people I love it. If you look at what the government looks at a beginning farmer, they say at least 10 years minimum. So, and I'm 3 years, and so I'm looking at, like, you telling me I can be farming for 10 years, I'm still a beginner farmer?
Yep.
So, you know, I just, you know, I'm more of like, I'm using farming and being basically just taking farming and showing people the fun side of it. Like, people look at my page and how I post stuff, you know, they want to learn. I open it up so people can come out and learn it. So I felt like if I can push more of my people, and I'm also elbowing older farmers too to get back into it. And how? Because I have a steady market. So I tell people, you know, I look for farmers that's growing on the side, that's been growing and going to the side of the corners selling their produce. Now what I do, I go to that corner and I say, man, I buy your whole truck. Why? Because I got a steady supply for how my produce go. So I'm taking my older farmers out the street, making them just focus on growing. I can get the produce, you know. So once you start with that, they're going to pass it down. And I want them to pass it down to their kids, their grandkids. So, you know, once people start seeing you interacting and making deals with older people, they're going to be like, okay, then. And now, you know, the older people don't mind passing it down because it's already established now. I'm trying to correct things that we had a problem with in the past. So,
Najma, why do you do the work that you do?
Because land is liberation, and I'm a freedom fighter. And it really is what everybody has shared. You know, I feel like our people, I feel like Black people, people of African descent, have this trauma associated with agriculture, especially younger Black people. And that is just, it's unconscionable. because agriculture is in our actual DNA. We are specialists. African people are specialists on the land. There is no there is no other group that has the documented history that we have on the land. And I feel like it is like I have a responsibility to use the skill sets that I have with regard to public policy to connect that with agriculture and making sure that these resources that are allocated to, you know, these large ag business farms that are not using sustainable practices per se, that did not, you know, that do not have this history of being marginalized on the land, making sure that there is some equity in that process. So I do the work that I don't have to do this work to eat. Thankfully, I'm in a different position, but I love to be on the farm. Like my brother has to come run me off the farm when it's time for me to go to class. But beyond that, it really is just about this drive to make sure that we can come back to the land. And we can come back to the land in a way where we can be self-determined. You know, if we want to work this land the way our ancestors did, we should be able to do that and not have to live hand to mouth. And there are a number of different ways that we can do that. If our elders want to make sure that their property stays in agricultural practice, they should be able to die in peace and comfort, knowing that the next generation is prepared to carry on that legacy for them and that they can take it to the next level. You know, all of that, but really it's just about liberating and coming back to our heritage. This is what, like, our ancestors suffered, bled, and died literally for us to be able to do this. It's a reclamation work for me and for many, many, many colleagues in the field who are doing the same thing. And I just feel very, very honored to be in a place and time to kind of advance that that work and be able to have fun on the farm doing it. So,
Ms. Felicia, why you do what you do besides the fact that you love it?
Oh, I love it. I love it. So my mantra have always been each one teach one. And that is really changing the narrative. A lot of our people have been taken down rabbit holes and I'm just there with the care to bring them out. I want them to know that they could do different, and that's continuing the legacy of my grandparents, what they taught me. I always, always wanted to be like them because they gave service. People to this day still do events and all this kind of stuff for my grandparents, and they passed away in the 90s. So just the things that they have done in our community and the service they have given, I want to be able to leave that type of legacy of helping people and, you know, for positiveness, though. And it will be still in that agriculture, but it's really to change the narrative. We could do so much better. And I agree with Najma. We were brought here for agriculture. So why are we still on the bottom? We have the knowledge, so it's up to us on this call and many other people to bring us out of that quote-unquote narrative and we're under the feet of other people. That's not us. We just have that mindset, and it's just a mindset change. So that's what I'm here to do.
Okay. All right. So and going along with that, as young leaders and as people who are doing the work in this community, what are your biggest challenges in your work? You know, what obstacles that you seem continue to be put in your way, and how do you try to overcome them? So, Otis, I'm going to go to you first. What are your biggest challenges in the work that you do?
Okay. Biggest challenges. I think the biggest challenges I've got past those biggest challenges. And I think those, I'll say it was kind of by the way that I've grown as far as my work. I think my first biggest challenges was just trying to build trust with people. When you have a, when you're trying to provide technical assistance to people who have been wronged for so many years, it's so hard to build that trust and say, look, I'm here to help you. I'm going to hold your hand and I'm going to take you to these government offices and we're going to get you the type of assistance that you need. So just trying to build trust was probably my biggest challenge. Second challenge, I guess, has been just holding on because, you know, for a couple of years, the actual small farming has been my way of making money. So just trying to hold on and just keep at it, just to make sure that you keep your eyes focused on the bigger picture has kind of been a challenge, especially when you know when you're trying to help people and you know that you're doing this for the greater good. Just trying to hold on and try to keep yourself mentally and physically going. But definitely, I think my biggest challenges has been and were just trying to build trust, especially when it comes down to our elders. Sometimes they're a little reluctant when they see somebody younger that's coming to them and trying to tell them about farming. I used to tell them, I'm not here to teach you how to farm. Because there's nothing that I can tell a guy that's been farming for 40, 50 years. I just can add to it. And so that was kind of my attitude about it. I'm not here to tell you that you're doing something wrong, but maybe there's something that I can help you with that we can enhance your farm, that we can really maximize your profits. You know what I'm saying? So, yeah, just trying to build trust with folks, I think, was the biggest challenge.
Alicia?
Oh, and of course, all of these rules and these regulations that are constantly changing, too. This policy is a challenge. Himself, and it's just so I would say trust and these policy changes, these rules and regulations that's happening, just it's just ridiculous for the small farmer.
Yeah, Felicia.
I think my two biggest challenges, then Mr. Otis just mentioned one. One is the mindset, like I said earlier, changing people's mindset has been the biggest challenge, and it's still along the lines of what Mr. Otis said. Second is believing the narrative of another group. So we've been taught that our traditional ways cannot make us money. And so we have so many people that believe that narrative. And so it's very hard to get them to understand that you can do it without chemicals. You can do it without antibiotics to your animals, and you make a good price. You still make money. And to be honest with you, we make profit. We ain't breaking even. And so those are the two main things. And then one on what Mr. Otis said about the policy, that's one of my biggest things. The reason why I'm doing this market garden project is pull yourself out of the game. Create your own game. And what I mean by that, even with our farm, you make a closed loop system. You create your own food system. So you're supplying to yourself. So you pull out of that game of jumping through hoops and all that kind of stuff. You create your own system.
Cedric?
I would say my biggest challenge would be climate change. The reason I say that because the time of growing stuff and plant stuff is not as simple as used to be. Usually you can, you know, plant after the first frost or, you know, so, you know, you had certain times of the year that you knew when to plant stuff. And now with the climate changing, you know, wintertime is not winter anymore. You know, we're experiencing cold weather. It's springtime now, going into summer still. So I say my biggest challenge is, like I said, climate change and also affecting beginning farmers because it's kind of giving them a less of hope of growing something because they're not so successful their first go around. It takes someone that's farming and basically been outdoors to understand when and when change needs to be happening done. So, you know, I think, you know, just trying to address climate change is hard. That's Mother Nature itself. We just have to basically train each other how to adapt to our surroundings and how things will grow now. A good example, like I said, I tell people I have watermelons early in Georgia now. People are so used to watermelons at a certain time in the year, but with the climate change, you see we're experiencing 7-degree weather right about now sometimes. So, you know, so seeds are germinating earlier. Bees are coming out confusing, but stuff is still getting pollinated. So, I mean, it's just, that's just nature at its best, you know, doing what it does. And we just have to adapt to it. So that's my biggest challenge.
Nadra?
One of my biggest challenges building bridges between our, you know, our younger generation and our elders, and just finding ways to translate in between, you know, being the in-between generation and trying to find ways to make sure that the knowledge and skill that our elders have can be documented and transferred to the next generation, and then getting them to see farming as a viable option. There's a lot of competition. It's a lot of noise that that's confronting young people. And again, with the trauma that's been associated with agriculture, when you say something like farming, you know, for a lot of our younger people, even in the Gullah Geechee community, and I think particularly in the Gullah Geechee community, because they're still trying to get away from what people have told them is, that's for poor Black folks. So trying to build those bridges before we lose too many elders and all of these libraries that they have with them burn down when they go. Trying to make sure our young people really are able to see the kind of farming that we do, the sustainable farming. And, you know, Felicia mentioned it, that you can make a decent living off of this, and that it farming is hot. How do we translate that into current generation speak, if you would, the things that they find interesting, trying to make those connections so that they don't miss out on this great opportunity to be independent, to be self-determined, to be healthy. that's a big challenge.
I found all your responses really, really interesting. You know what I really found interesting? Not one of you mentioned money. Now, not a single one of you mentioned money. And I know we convened a series of calls in conjunction with Tuskegee University. And that always comes up as something that people say is an impediment to them doing better. So I don't know if it's listening to your backgrounds. Felicia, you said that you would do all those trips on your own dime. You know, Otis, you said you would do this work, you know, just out of your thing. You guys sort of, you're hustlers, let's put it that way. And I don't mean that in a bad way, but it's just interesting that when I talk to other groups, we don't have enough money to get this done, but yet you guys are getting your work done. So that's pretty cool. We got a few minutes left, and the one thing I really want to close with, because it has illuminated and exacerbated so many problems within our community, is I want you to speak a little bit about the impact of COVID in your communities and on the farmers that you work with. You know, what new problems have been introduced as a result of the virus, and what do you see as problems that were already there and COVID has just made them worse? So if each of you could spend a couple of minutes talking about that. Raise your hand if you want to go first. All right, I'll pick somebody. Felicia.
So, yes, sir, with the pandemic, it brought things to the light. And that's one, and also it showed in the education system, is no broadband. So mm-hmm. many people thought in our country that everyone had internet. But this brought it to the light that no, everyone is not blessed to have that. And so that was the biggest issue that I saw in our areas, that they still to this day can't get on Zoom call. And so one of the things that I made sure, because I immediately pivoted and started doing online workshops, but I made sure my organization had call-in function. That was they had to do it. I wasn't going to take anything less, because I knew that our people didn't have that access to just jump online. And so that was the biggest thing. The other is online store. Even myself, I had a store I had created, but it was in the cut. I hadn't even brought it live, because I was like, we're doing face-to-face vending, direct marketing. You know, I'm running it. We doing good. And I don't need the store right now. Not realizing, yeah, I needed it just to have that out to the side, but it made me pull forward. But I'm able to create the store. We have so many, like I said, older farmers that wouldn't know how to begin. So it has been very, very hard for farmers to pivot. It's been a lot of phone calls we're having to make because they can't get on Zoom. One of the things we're getting ready to do now as well, I got to send out postcards. I got to do it the old-fashioned way. because everybody wants to send out emails, but every farmer don't have an email address. So it's making these assumptions that everybody is like everybody else. And that's been my biggest hang up with other ag professionals, trying to get them to understand you gotta follow your farmer. What do your farmer need? Don't keep it up in the air with you and make it easy for you. What do your farmer need? So this pandemic has really brought a lot to the light, but we can do it. We got all these people on this, and we got so many other people out here helping, and I know that we'll be able to solve our own problem.
Yeah, it's funny how you say the old-fashioned ways. We funded an effort by Virginia State. They just went back to hard copy newsletters. You know, they're really nice. They just spend the money and they mail them out. You know, you know, I said we could be too tech-centric as a country sometimes. You forget how to pick up the phone. Excuse me. You forget how to read something. So those always are coming back. Excuse me. Cedric, yeah, what have you seen? What has been the impact of COVID on your community?
Okay, well, if people know, Albany, Georgia was one of the hard-hit areas with the COVID. We had a lot of people pass away. I lost two loved ones to COVID myself. So the impact it had was a bad, because it kept a lot of businesses from getting the typical service that they usually get, especially farmers with markets. You know, those pop-up stands and people that go to farmer markets and stuff, it kind of put them on the back burner. The good side, it kind of opened up for more of a virtual type deal. So it challenged farmers on how to sell their produce and get it out there. So a lot of farmers are able to make it easier as far as transportation, since they don't have to travel to market. They can basically send produce or, you know, just do drop-offs or whatever. So it gave some farmers a new marketing strategy and scheme, you know, on a positive side. But it's nothing positive about the COVID at all. So, it played a big effect. So, but if I had to look, I can say it wasn't a positive. That was a change that was made in farming. Mm-hmm. Farming went more virtual. Farming went more social distancing, when it's basically something that involves social gathering. You know, people mm-hmm. coming and looking at produce, getting attached with the farmer, you know, knowing where their produce come from. So now, you know, people are not familiar where their produce come from. Now it opens up to where people can people took advantage of flooding the market with produce in grocery stores. Like, you start getting more toxic produce. You know, stuff wasn't monitored like it used to. You got less people, less USDA people, you know. So, you know, like, it's just a lot of shortage on things, and people weren't really paying attention to stuff. And, you know, so, you know, the produce system kind of got, you know, messed up. Grocery stores were kind of slow, you know, like, not say slow, but they was behind on stocking up produce and stuff like that. So, you know, that impact basically was the agriculture field in my area wasn't ready for that particular type of, you know, event. So
sorry to hear about your loved ones, Cedric. And I have a question, if you don't mind answering it. You know, I look at social media a lot. That's how I keep up with folks, because I cover such a big territory. I'm always amazed, especially at Black people who continue to state that COVID's this government plan and it's not really real. And as someone who's lost some loved ones to the actual disease, what would you say to somebody who told you something like that, that it's not a real disease, it's made up? What would you say?
I would say you don't understand war, because mm-hmm. war is not always about guns and bullets. Mm-hmm. Sometimes war is, you know, chemical war. Sometimes war is getting rid of population. When, you know, they taught us in school, you know, the massacre, people killing off a certain kind. Just start paying attention to, you know, I tell people, just pay attention to more about what you see on TV. Everything is always about black. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I tell them it's another way to get rid of people without physically touching mm-hmm. them, or, you know, so I tell, you know, it's really hard to say, because my love, it kind of hit me shockingly. And with me being a public health major, you know, I took up pandemics and stuff and know the nature of pandemics. So I just tell people, you know, pay attention to war, you know, understand war, understand what is other ways to kill off people rather than just bullets and guns. And, you know, that's what I just tell people, you know, because, you know, I really don't like to get in details and trying to sway no one's opinion or anything. But it just, you know, it hits different when it hit close to home. So when someone, you know, when it hit close to home, that's when they realize it is real.
So who did I go to? Najma, how's COVID affected your community?
Well, we, you know, our co-op here participated in the, you know, the boxes for community members. Mm-hmm. So they, in that aspect, there really was an opportunity there for a lot of the farmers to get in on that. That program that the USDA did, they've since changed some of the rules. So I think it's going to be difficult for a lot of our farmers to participate because they don't produce meat. And, you know, that gets me right back to the policy intersection, you know, whereas we had a group of smaller farmers who were able to respond in this crisis time. It was neighbors feeding neighbors and, you know, being supported by these government resources that really should be coming our way. But then, you know, a change to the policy, and I will argue a change in the favor of larger ag producers. Definitely. Really, you know, just excludes, again, a group that has been historically marginalized and left out of the resource allocation conversation. So that, you know, I saw the plus and the minus there in terms of, you know, being able to network, though. You know, it goes without saying that COVID-19 hit our community just in a devastating way, you know, in terms of the disproportionate amount of our community members who contracted and also died from the disease. So I don't want to minimize that at all. What I found, though, in terms of networking, because of, you know, the inability or the lack of desire to meet face to face with a lot of organizations, you know, the South Carolina Black Farmers Coalition has been able to meet in a way that I don't think we would have been able to do if we weren't in this sort of lockdown situation. People were available on every other Saturday. We didn't have to drive. You know, we've got folks meeting from St. Helena and Charleston and Columbia and, you know, Greenville, all over the state, and really doing this amazing work around planning, around providing resources for young farmers, around advocating for justice for Black farmers at the state level. And this kind of work, I mean, it was just rapid fire work from the last conference in March till we're coming up on the third conference in next month. And the work that we were able to accomplish, what we were able to do in 6 months between June and December, I don't think would have happened if we weren't in the environment that was produced because of COVID. So you've seen it a couple of different ways.
That Farm to Families box program was really interesting to look at. You know, when it first came out, you basically had a week to fill out the application. What I understand, though, these first boxes were fairly good because they had a lot of local foods in them. But I understand this last iteration, it was mainly processed foods, hot dogs and very, very little on the fresh produce side. So and as you said, you know, it was definitely geared toward big ag. So Otis, you get the last word on this, man. What's been the impact of COVID in the Jackson area?
So COVID, of course, we had high numbers. We still have high numbers. I think I might have mentioned this to y'all that the office that I'm at now, we actually shut down because a guy came in last Monday. He called in Thursday and said that he tested positive. So they shut down the office. Well, we shut down now because of COVID, but they supposed to sanitize the office, and we had to go get tests and everything like that. All my stuff came back negative, so that's good. But yeah, I've had some family members. I actually got an uncle and an aunt now that recently have contracted it. Both are diabetics and older, but they are doing fine. My parents are older and have some issues, but they haven't caught it. They actually took their first round of their shots, which I'm really not fond of, but, you know, with them being older and a little worried, you know, you can't really, you know, everybody has to do what they need to do. I don't plan on taking them. I just don't. But huh?
You're not gonna take it?
I'm still praying about that. I really don't want to. I'm not planning on doing it right now. If I did, it'll be 6 months to a year from now. But I really don't want to. Period. So, but I know they got some stuff about, you know, you won't be able to travel and all that. And I'm like, well, maybe I just drive everywhere and don't worry about going out of the country if I got to show you a shot record. I don't know. I'm still kind of up in the air with it. But I think that, so yeah, there have been some hardships. But I tell you, Miss Bell told me something, and I don't know if she remembers this, but a couple of months ago when me and her were, when we were at the farmer's market, she said that how we were talking about those big farms shutting down because of COVID. And she said because they didn't know how to market small. And I saw a lot of us small farmers actually did good and have been doing good during this pandemic. You got people, if they couldn't go to the farmer's market, they actually opened up their farms for people to drive through and pick up produce boxes. So I think with Black people, I think we've always been in a pandemic because we know how to. That's all I got to say about that. We've always been in a pandemic. And I think that we just know how to get around things. So, yeah, that's pretty much it. It's really just another day for us. I just say that. It's another year.
Yeah, well, we got a couple minutes left before we wrap up. I really appreciate the four of you taking time with me today. But one quick thing I wanted to touch on was it's come up several times since throughout the call. It's this whole issue of policy and understanding policy and getting involved in policy. I don't know if you guys have read Senator Cory Booker's Justice for Black Farmers Act that they just put into the brought it back up to the Senate. It expired in the last term. And a lot of people are like, yeah, this is going to be really, really good. But nobody takes the time to actually sit down and read what that stuff is about. Or on the other side, people who's trying to push those policies really don't come to our communities and explain that stuff. It's a good start with Senator Booker's act. I had a lot of issues with it. But I'm not going to pick on anybody if you have some certain feelings about it. But just talk about, you know, the importance of policy and how it impacts your work, just so people know that, you know, all this stuff don't happen in a vacuum. I think who mentioned the farm bill? Was that Cedric? Was that Otis? Somebody mentioned the farm bill. You know, none of this stuff happens in a vacuum. And that's why it's important for our folks to really understand policy. So with that, I'll just open it up if anybody wants to give any last words about that. You got it, Najma.
I would just say, you know, all politics is local and all, you know, we are trying to advocate at the state level for a Justice for Black Farmers Act, because, and that's not, is nothing against Senators Booker and Warren and those. I'm in agreement with you, Brennan. There's some things in that bill that are problematic, and there are also some very beneficial things there, particularly what the newest piece around canceling Pigford debt. That would be really encouraging if that could be added to that federal piece. But what I would advocate for folks, or what I would recommend for folks, is to get engaged at the local and your state level, because those are, you know, those policies and practices are closer to where you are, and you have probably a better shot at getting the ear of policymakers at your state level, or, you know, call your representatives and engage them in a local bill or a state bill, so that, you know, you get to give input. And I'll give you an example. You know, the South Carolina Black Farmers Coalition, we invited our representative to come to our meeting, and he had not heard about the bill that we were interested in getting support on. But once we brought it to his attention, he went and co-signed on it. And he said, you know, I'm willing to recommend that the South Carolina Black Farmers Coalition be one of the lead agencies to come in and speak during committee hearings. So, it, you know, a bill is one thing, but, you know, speaking during those committee hearings, that's where you can actually craft the legislation and give input and say, yeah, we really like these pieces, not so much about these pieces. And this is why we think it should, you know, you need to take this out and shape it this way. I just encourage us to get engaged at that process well before, you know, it comes out of committee. You know, we need to be influencing our representatives and giving them, you know, feeding them that information. It's advocacy, y'all. It's not necessarily always lobbying. It's, you know, if you're at a 501c3, I understand there's some concerns around lobbying, but advocacy and informing your policymakers about what makes sense and giving them enough information so that you can, as an organization or even as an individual, shape the final outcomes of some of these bills. That would be my recommendation, to really get involved at that level.
Yeah. I saw this thread on Facebook, I think it was yesterday or the day before, and they were going to bet. It started out about Biden's pick of Vilsack as the ag secretary, which I think was a horrible pick, but that's for another day. But they were going back and forth between whether it's the Republicans or the right, whether it was the Democrats. And, you know, one thing I said, you know, the person who has the most impact on your farming operation is that person sitting at local FSA office, you know, because when you go to file for a FSA application or if you want to get your NRCS, those are the people who have on the ground control. And we need to start to exert our voice at those levels. I know within Senator Booker's act, there's some talk about cleaning that up. But, you know, we've been trying to clean that up for years. So so I want to thank all of you for spending some time. Have all of you started your projects yet?
I have.
OK. Yeah. You know, if there's any issues with the weather and stuff, you know, you just get in contact with me. We're flexible on how to make this stuff happen. But I hope we can have this call again as you get. Actually, the plan was before COVID hit was for us to come out and take pictures. I know that Ian's going to be contacting you to try and get articles in your local newspapers and just doing some stories that we're going to be sending out on the National SAIR website. But I'm really pleased that the four of you are doing these projects. I don't think we could have picked a better cohort. And good luck to you. You know, we're here if you have any questions. So thanks a lot and good luck. And please stay warm and be careful out there. Have a great
night. Thank you for listening to the Sustainable Ag Writer podcast. Please visit our website at sustainableagwriter.com, where you can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. If you found value in this show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Please tell your friends and colleagues about the show and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Once again, thank you for listening to the Sustainable Ag Writer podcast, sustainable ag news and views.